session number 10743, row 4.
Yes, he got his training, and instead of firing in bursts, he kept his fingers on the trigger and at point-blank range poured in the 4,000 rounds that were in the belts of his guns. Whether it was from the sheer weight of the bullets going in or whether he'd been hit in a vital spot immediately, we don't know, but the plane dropped like a bullet straight down to the ground. It crashed just under some light clouds. I believe this was confirmed from another source at the time, but it was still only claimed as a probable because we did not actually see it hit the ground itself, but barely under the cloud. The gunner, who partly because of his two tours, but principally because of this incident, was later awarded the DFC when he finished his second tour with us.
And you were never actually shot down yourself?
No, we had, because of fires on board and being hit with flak, I think it was twice or three times I had my parachute pack on, ready to go, and the skipper was able to hold things, so we had no real trouble that way.
How did your tour with 10 Squadron end? Did it go into 1945?
Yes, it went in 1945. February was a good month in that we completed 8 trips, 7 of them at night and 1 as a daylight raid on Mainz. The last two occurred in March when I was screened for the second time.
When you were?
Screened. That was the technical term for coming off ops at that stage.
What did that involve, the screening?
Just that you were could be allocated to other jobs. There is a small point here that probably rashly a couple of years before, when losses were very high, someone had decided that should they ever have anybody who survived two tours, they would arrange that he would be able to have a say in where he was posted afterwards. Accordingly, I was sent off on indefinite leave, ready for the next posting, but I'd only been on leave for about a week or so when I got a recall telegram telling me to report to a place called Westcott in Buckinghamshire, with no explanation at all. When I arrived on Westcott station, it was to find another 20 or 30 aircrew, some of whom just finished their first, and the odd one who'd finished his second tour. No one had any idea what we were there for. It turned out next day that we were due to take charge of repatriation of British prisoners of war, which were coming back from Germany. And it was a job which covered the next 2 months.
What did it involve?
Well, we had to act as a reception crew. We had to take names, the details of each person, and then we had a very elaborate arrangement for dividing all the prisoners up into their particular sections and sending them off to special camps. Now, we had to divide them between the services, between the countries, the dominions, and we had, I think, about 30 different places they could be sent to. While they were with us, many of the people were shocked, very seriously shocked, after 4 years of captivity and suddenly being whipped back to this country. We had to handle them very carefully. We had many volunteer WAFs on the station who looked after them, gave them cups of tea, generally spoke to them, and while we were waiting to ship them off into these lorries or by train, I forgot to say that because I was the senior one there, I was put in charge, and I found an MT officer from London who came to act as an advisor on the transport side. The army produced a colossal number of 6-ton trucks, which we had to use as and when, some cases sending one man possibly on a 100-mile journey in a 6-ton truck. But considering all the problems and the fact there'd never been anything like this before, it went off very smoothly. Winston Churchill had sent a special message that no expense was to be spared in getting these people back into sort of a relative comfort at home. We worked all hours of the day and night. The original idea had been that I think it was 20 different aerodromes all over East and Southern England were to be allocated so many planes per day. Unfortunately, the system broke down. Some of the heavy planes landing on the smaller aerodromes broke up the surface, and we suddenly found that instead of 20, there were only about half a dozen working, and even that came to an abrupt halt. We found that there were just three drones able to take the aircraft. There was Wing, where I'd been in previous years, Westcott, which wasn't very far away, and my satellite at Westcott, the other drone.
And what a
satellite drone. You know, you had a main drone and you had a satellite, a runway there. These were the only three that were actually operating. That partly came about because of the serviceability of the drones, but also because there'd been, if you like, a breakdown in the organisation. What had happened in particular was that the Americans were flying Dakotas across with jerry cans, the petrol cans, and landing where they could, usually on the autobahn, and dropping these petrol cans along the sides of the road to be picked up. Now, while they were doing that, a lot of our prisoners of war who'd been marching backwards and forwards, first towards the Eastern Front, then back towards the Western Front, were on the road, having been released and in a bad state. And the pilots were asking them if they'd like a lift back. And these chaps were accepting. So we suddenly found that we were getting aircraft for which there'd been no schedule whatsoever, were appearing on the circuits with these prisoners of war. We were expecting to pick up something like 100 men a day to transport through our centre. And we suddenly found situations where ending up to 20 aircraft, 20 Dakotas would appear on the circuit, each with 30 men in. So you'd have 600 men landing. Of course, we called on all the volunteers to handle them. And unfortunately, again, they didn't restrict their hours to decent times, so that at 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd suddenly find you'd just been to sleep for an hour or 2 hours, you get a call out again, another 10 aircraft on the circuit, you know, and, oh, God, I've never been so tired. Anyway, it worked out very well indeed. I think there were 100,000 prisoners expected through, and I think we took on our one pair of drones about 60,000 of them.
When you said they needed careful handling, do you mean to say they might fly off the handle?
No, they might collapse in tear sometimes, or actually collapse, because the sort of thing that happened was that when they went into these hangars, which we converted into places where they were sprayed with the newfangled DDT, every man was sprayed, and this was a little bit undignified. They shot them down their trousers, up their shirts and everything else there with these flit sprays. Many of them had really been in German hands less than 24 hours before, so that they were in a state of complete confusion. They had to be led in certain directions. You saw the way where they'd gathered their kit. They'd had possibly over 4 or 5 years, or 4 years certainly, their soap, their little personal belongings, which they had to put down while they were being deloused and while they were having their cup of tea. And to begin with, their eyes would never leave these little piles on the floor. After a while, they began to relax, and of course what happened inevitably was that possibly after 2 hours of being there and then being loaded into trucks, they walked straight past these possessions which they'd sort of guarded and forgot all about them. So every night we had to clear up all sorts of things, of which there was very little way of identifying. Some had numbers on, some hadn't, and but it was rather pathetic to see all these things, as I say, which they'd so jealously guarded, completely forgotten. We had some come back with things we had to take away. We had one party on the aircraft come back. Each man had a shotgun, beautiful German shotgun. When these prisoners of war were marching past a place that our troops had overrun in northern Germany, one of our bulldozers was going over the top of all the shotguns taken from the factory in the yard and was smashing them all up. And one of the, prisoners said, couldn't we have one? And they said, help yourself. So every man came off with a shotgun, beautiful one. Unfortunately, we had to take them all away from them. But
so that was the last job that you actually did in the RAF, wasn't it?
No. What happened then was the RAF kept their promise. After about 2 months on this job, I was sent off again on leave to await a new job in which I would have some sort of choice. Now, I registered myself in Whitehall at the appropriate department, and every week I was phoned to say that there were a few jobs going, would I care to consider them? Well, I'd been on leave for about 3 or 4 weeks because what they were offering me, frankly, was not anything I would have liked anyway. And then I was called rather excitedly by this officer concerned. I've got a good job that might be, it might interest you. So I went down to Whitehall and was told that there was a section which I'd never heard of before called the Top Secret Dispatch Couriers. Their job was to carry all top secret dispatches around the world. For instance, when Churchill made his visits abroad, there was always one courier every day following him behind with all the top secret stuff and also bringing it back. So they went to Canada, to Yalta, North Africa, everywhere he went, that was part of their duties to follow him. When they weren't working specifically for Churchill, they were carrying all sorts of top secret stuff for the Army, Navy or Air Force. Now, at that stage, the more interesting trips, as I would have termed them, had virtually gone. But the section, which only which consisted of six officers and, I believe, two corporals, one was about to retire and they needed a replacement. I went to see this place at what they called the Rotunda, the office, which was two floors underground, just off Horse Ferry Road. Colossal great concrete bunker, as it was. I wasn't able to see the CO. I met his deputy, and during a little preliminary discussion we got on to crosswords. This was supposed to be an interview for the job, I may say, and I learnt that he'd been setting the crossword for the Times Telegraph and Radio Times before the war, and I was interested. After about half an hour's discussion on all this, I said, well, you know, shouldn't we start the interview proper? He said, you're in. So, and I became a courier. Now, as I say, it was late in the war, so the interesting trips were no longer there. I think the only one that I could have attended was cancelled. That was to Iceland. But what I did get involved in was the a so-called milk run to Belgium and Germany. We sent one or two couriers every week, sometimes three or four, to Montgomery in Germany, also to the Naval CNC in Minden, and carrying what we called the Admiral's washing. But all the top secret stuff had to go through, in many cases, through Brussels, because we picked up and returned other stuff there as well. So that I found myself roughly twice a week staying in Brussels overnight and catching early planes out in either direction. It was a very interesting period. I liked the job. It was varied occasionally by a trip up to the by car to Great Malvern to the then secret place TRE to pick up top secret stuff, including the plates which had been used by the Enigma type equipment that we were using, to have them officially broken up in Whitehall. Occasional one to Northern Ireland, one or two up to Prestwick to pick up stuff from other couriers coming across the Atlantic. I had that job until I was actually demobbed.
When was that approximately?
April 1946.
So you're doing the dispatch work 45, 46?
Yes. We had a letter which we carried with us, which authorised us to take priority in many cases, to break the rule about all official documents in an aircraft being handed to the pilot. We kept those on our own person. We were allowed to exceed the speed limit on the roads, and we had instructions to ensure that we got our documents at the highest possible speed backwards and forwards, and to that extent we were authorised to demand passengers on aircraft, even to the extent of turning people off to get on. Now, I didn't have to use that much because, fortunately, from Northolt there was a twice daily service on Anson's to the continent, the air delivery service to the ADLS, to the forces there. And in many cases, I flew by Anson, so I had many Anson flights, backwards and forwards, during that period. Very little of event. We took over one of the best hotels in Brussels as a permanent, the permanent bedroom there, and it really was, although it was at times a little hectic in making dates and driving across the autobahns at night and things like this. It really was a worthwhile job, I felt at the time. I was offered a permanent commission at the end, but was told the job itself would probably peter out and much of the activity would go back to the so-called Silver Greyhounds, the Foreign Office Special Messenger Service. And as I wasn't interested in any other part of the RAF, I decided not to accept it.
Could I ask you one or two questions in general about the bomber offensive during the war? Because many people like Bennett and so on have talked about the tremendous contribution that the bomber offensive played in the war, saying they made the point that for a bomber crew, each particular operation was like a battle for somebody in the army, and yet you had a whole tour of these. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I do. I've seen at different times in the past comparisons about the number of shells that were thrown at a comparatively small number of aircraft compared with the barrages of the 14-18 war. And it was reckoned that many trips on places like the Ruhr were certainly the equivalent of going over the top in some of the worst battles of that war. The First World War was characterised by the fact that we lost a heck of a lot of subalterns, young subalterns, 50, 60, 70,000, I believe, from distant memory. But we lost close on 60,000 aircrew, mostly in Bomber Command. During that period of the run-up, principally 43 to 44 and 45, and as Harris himself pointed out, we actually suffered more fatal casualties in that time than the entire British forces invading Europe. So certainly the contribution, I think, was terrific. It was a pity. Up until the last stages of the war, there was no doubt about the RAF was particularly Bomber Command, was a favourite with the public. Political views suddenly changed in 45. Now, people were looking ahead, they realised the war was running downhill, and it was more politics than anything else that mattered, and the fact that you besmeared some of your opponents was quite legitimate at that stage. It became a political business. Some of the stories I've seen in print since are absolutely ridiculous. The suggestion that aircrew themselves could select a target or decide not to go or go anywhere at all was so ridiculous. You never knew what was there anyway. You were told, you were given a picture, you were given a target, you were told what was in that particular aiming point and what was round about it, but no one said to you that there's thousands of refugees here or anything like that at all. And Dresden, I've seen reports on that. The suggestion seemed to be the aircrew should have refused to go. On the other hand, they didn't know anything about this, but because I believe no aircraft were shot down in the Dresden raid, that was regarded as a demerit. If, as had been possible that night, the RAF, the Luftwaffe, had been able to get off the deck correctly and attack and shoot down a lot of our aircraft, there might have been some justification. Now, we've heard stories about the fact that the Luftwaffe, in its form of night fighters, were still able to deal a crippling blow against any formation, but owing to what I heard was the CO having been killed at an early stage, no instructions were given for any fighter planes to take off. They were just sat around the whole raid. Now, to my mind, as I say, if they'd taken off and if the aircraft had been shot down, if there'd been more British blood spent at that particular time, it would have been regarded as legitimate. Who was to know these refugees were there? Certainly the aircrew didn't know. People might have known higher up the tree. But as it was, we'd heard the Russians had specifically asked us to bomb these towns, and they were our allies, even if we're rather distant allies, and this was carried out. But the vilification of the Bomber Command after the war was absolutely atrocious. I just didn't understand why this sudden abrupt change, except on political grounds.
Do Bomber Command people nowadays feel aggrieved about this type of thing?
Oh yes, very seriously, because the effect was that, as you probably know, campaign medals were issued to most people for anything that was notable, the Western Desert and things like this, but nothing was given to the RAF for Bomber Command offensive the whole time. Harris, the stories vary a bit there, but he was the only one of the commanders who wasn't made whatever it is, a baron or any other particular title. He wasn't given, and he was ostracised. He was an individualist. He knew what he wanted. They never gave him what he wanted, but they criticised him because he didn't achieve what he said, despite the fact they hadn't given him what he'd asked for. So, no, we felt aggrieved on his score too. We really felt he'd been shabbily treated. Yes, there's certainly this. As you probably know, there's in the last year or two, there's been an attempt by the people still surviving to set their own medal up. There have been petitions for that particular thing, and an unofficial one has in fact been adopted, I believe. I wouldn't take it myself because it's not worthwhile. I think it's got to be an official one or nothing.
You've touched on criticisms of Bomber Command there. There are really two basic criticisms which have been made. One on the grounds that you've touched on, of that it's not a moral thing to bomb civilians, and the other one is that the resources could have better been used for some other purpose.
Well, take the first one. The Germans had a far better system of air raid shelters than we ever had. The vast majority of the towns we were attacking, most of the people were down in the shelters, and we knew that. The idea was to disrupt a lot of the light industry, which, as in this country, was being used to bolster the main factories, was spread throughout the different areas. You couldn't have bombed them individually. The only way was to take a complete area out, and this is what was happening. And if you'd seen the results of some of those raids, it was frightening in that half a town would have disappeared. But most of the people that were in there had already gone to shelters. Some were killed, but the losses were never in proportion to the amount of damage that was done. Hamburg was a terrific case, as you probably know. Speer, the armaments sort of director, he's on record as having said that if we could have done this on two or three more towns, it could probably have knocked their resistance right out. People attacked the RAF, but I believe the RAF sank more German capital ships than the Navy did themselves, sank a lot of shipping, a lot of submarines. It really was multifarious operation, the way the things were being done. We were bombing things in Friedrichshafen, right the way up to Norway, attacking U-boats up there, attacking the battleships, bombing the sites down over the channel. Now, this is something that Harris reckoned in his term was a waste of time, because these were precision targets that should have had precision attacks rather than the type of aerial bombing which we had to adopt. The Americans, certainly during many of their earlier daylight raids, were no better. In fact, they were very much worse in many of their attacks, the scattering and places like that. I did hear in Germany there was the feeling that the Americans did more damage to the civilians than the RAF did, which was totally different from the view that was held after war over here. But they did a fantastic job. We did a very good job indeed. So I feel these recriminations are out of balance. They hadn't looked at the whole picture. The fact that all these factories were knocked out. When the invasion was taking place, the guns that were attacked, before the invasion took place, all the marshalling yards across France and Belgium were attacked, and many of these raids were actually pinpoint accurate on marshalling yards. They would take a complete marshalling yard out with all its warloads and leave the houses intact either side. Many of the photographs I saw confirmed that. We were using newer techniques at that time, and it really was turning into a pinpoint bombing type attack. We caught a cold on one or two of those trips because the Germans somehow seemed to anticipate we were going. friend of mine in the RAF was killed at Mailhacan, which is one of those where I think something like 42 planes went down in about 15 minutes because the German flak gunners were waiting for them. But there was a lot of this build-up, but somehow it's all lost in a wash. Dresden seems to be the thing that has reversed everything that happened throughout the war. One thing I'd like to add is about the accuracy of bombing in the later stage of the war due to the terrific improvement in bomb sights. The original Mark 9 bomb sight was frankly a very sort of simple affair which gave little accuracy and took no account of all the different variabilities that they met in bombing. The Mark 14 was a jump into a completely new age. Here, instead of looking at a sort of back sight and front sight, as with a rifle, we suddenly for the first time had a device which enabled us to look both at the bomb sight in effect and the ground at the same time. One of the problems with the old bomb sight was that if you were looking at the bomb sight itself, then you had to adjust when you wanted to look at the ground, which was 20,000 feet away. With a new type of bomb sight, this was completely overcome. You actually looked into a solid block of glass, and by means of a light source from over the top of your head, you saw reflected there what appeared to be a sword of red light. Now, the idea was to guide the aircraft onto the target and get the target to slide down, in effect, the shaft of the sword until it met the cross-section. And at the cross-section, you press the bomb release, and of course, away it went. When running up to a target, particularly against flak, you couldn't fly straight and level for any length of time, otherwise you'd have been caught. So the pilot had to dodge backwards and forwards. Now, with the gyros which supported this glass plate, that was overcome because you kept in the same position relative to the ground, despite the fact that the pilot might be banking the complete aircraft to port or starboard. So you could get a continuous straight line, as I say, with your eyes fully accommodated, and it's the type of thing that anyone with very little practice could have used. It was supported by a computer, a mechanical computer, which I believe eventually drove its designer, this is the popular fallacy perhaps, drove him mad in designing a single plate. It was a highly successful operational bombsight, so much so that the Americans, when they came over here with their Schneider and another type of bombsight, which they reputedly could use to drop bombs in apple barrels, they found that their own bomb sights under operational conditions just didn't work. So they went for the Mark 14. As is inevitable during war, the production here wasn't sufficient, so it was transferred to the States, where it appeared literally months later in large numbers, but renumbered the P1. And I had the